Hello, welcome back to Creative Chit Chat. I'm Ryan McLeod. This is episode 114, and I'm joined by Katie Murie this week, lead consultant at Service Design Academy. And she sort of takes me through how she fell into service design and how she got involved in it, as it was just sort of, I suppose, being popularized as a sort of term within design, and where that sort of initial step led her. But one of the things I wanted to pull out before we go into the episode was a sort of a quote that I've kind of paraphrased from there that really stuck out when I was doing the edit. It's, if we can be more human, step back and ask more questions rather than making assumptions in any walk of life, then it's going to be a better place going forward. It really stuck out, and I think we go on to talk about empathy and the importance of that in design, but also sort of in life in general. And I think, yeah, if we could all have that little bit more empathy, like, and consideration for others, it could be so totally transformational. And everyone has sort of shit days and dark times, and we don't always talk about that. And yeah, you don't always have that understanding that someone may have said something, done something, acted in a certain way, and it's down to things that you can't understand or sort of see at that point. And I think it's really important, and something that really that we could all be better at, probably. And then we also go on to talk about that, I suppose, like, if you think about empathy as a skill, we go on to talk about design and sort of core competency, and how design could be considered as, should be considered as similar to sort of maths or English, and that if we could teach people, I mean, at any point in their life, but particularly when they're young, design skills, or these sort of core creative and problem solving skills, then the potential to then go on and change their lives, change the world, is enormous, and have this sort of inherent design knowledge and understanding at such a sort of broad level across Scotland, I suppose. And yeah, we touch on that, and Katie sort of talks about a few projects and different things that she's been involved in or has seen that are sort of starting to do that in a little way. There's lots in this, but those are sort of the bits that I pulled out that were really sort of fascinating. But yeah, let's just get into the episode. So this is episode 114 with Katie Murie.
So when you asked me to think about my creative journey, I instantly was pulled back to my childhood and thinking about all of the different creative things I did probably across primary school. So writing poems about dolphins from family favourite holiday destinations, creating routines for gymnastics competitions, and playing violin, which my nan absolutely loved. And as soon as I started moving into high school, I think a lot of those things dropped off. You know, playing violin wasn't quite cool as you went into high school. And I started really focusing in on trying to be a good academic student. But my teenage years were a little bit wild. So I did okay at school, but I didn't do brilliantly. And my family have a history of solicitors. So two of my cousins were solicitors. So it's very much set up, you should be a solicitor. That's a good way to go in life. And it did appeal to me for a little bit. And I don't know if that's because I think at that age, I thought solicitors got paid a lot of money or whether the criminal law really appealed to me from watching your CSIs and NCISs. And I went down that road because that was the only thing that I could see in front of me at that point. And when I went to the University of Dundee and did my legal training, my law school training, I was there for 4 years and it was really, really tough. I realised then that, you know, remembering cases from back in 1980 to inform your work today was not really what I wanted to be doing. But I stuck it out and I got my degree in 2012, I finished up at the law school and went to work at a solicitor's here in Dundee, lasted about 8 months, then swiftly ran out of the door.
So, like, before you jump on from there, are there things that you think you learned or that you took from that experience, those sort of four and a half and a bit years, that you still think are valuable now?
Absolutely, yeah. I think pushing yourself and realising that every time I started a new subject in law, I would have a meltdown. I can't do this. There's no way I'm going to be able to do this. I don't understand it. And actually giving yourself that time to process what's going on, to read all of the information, take everything in, and move forward with it has taught me a lot about dedication to a subject, you know. And I was passionate about it. I did like elements of it, but I was very much drawn to family law. And that was the complete opposite of what I went into thinking. I'm going to be a criminal solicitor and I'm going to be in the courts. And actually, by the end of it, I was more focused on helping people. And that was what really led me to believe that being a solicitor wasn't for me. You know, when they're tracking people's time and they're charging you per word on a letter, I just thought, that's not what I want to do. I started to fall in love with family law because I felt that I could help people when they were in a time of need and give them direction in a subject that's really complex in the world. So I think a lot of that then translates into the world that I'm in now in design and being able to help people see things from a different lens. So I took a lot from my law degree, even just being able to finish it. You know, that was an achievement in itself. And I think it made my family proud, but it certainly didn't make me happy in the workplace. It didn't help that the traineeship that I went into was in investment law. So I had no affinity to it, you know. I had no feeling towards it whatsoever. So quite quickly dropped that and went back to education. And I remember looking for a master's course that was going to be suitable. But it's really difficult when you don't know what you want to do. So I spoke to my mum about it and she'd said, well, why don't you do something in management or leadership? And that gives you a really good grounding to start off and you can go into anything with that. And when we started to look at the courses that were available, so this would have been probably about 2014, we started to look at the courses that were available. Mum was looking at the curriculum and going, that's what I did 15 years ago. You don't want to do that. And that was your sort of standard MBAs and, you know, sort of management training in that business field. And it was just by chance we came across a dual qualification between Duncan & Jorgensen, so the art school here in Dundee, and the education school. And what they were trying to do was create a dual qualification that focused in on that leadership, but also with innovation. And that's something that really appealed to me. I thought that's really future-focused. And the curriculum looks really good, but it was the first time that they were running it, so there was nobody I could speak to about how that felt or what the experience was or what sort of job you would get afterwards. So I signed up to that, and that was when I met Mike Press. So Mike at that time was still teaching at the University of Dundee, but he was also working alongside Hazel with Open Change, so a local design agency here in Dundee. And Mike really opened my eyes to the world of design. We were set a project where we had to tackle a workplace problem. And at that point, I was actually working in the university at the medical school. So I was working with graduates, people becoming graduate doctors. So in their final year of doctor training. And I started to apply some of the design principles that I was learning to solving problems there. So the first workshop that I ran was around turning paper-based assessments into something digital so that we could track them much easier for the students' benefits as well as for the office benefit. And that was really, really successful. And once I finished my master's in leadership and innovation, I started to get into the design community. And at that point, it was normally a meetup in a local pub someplace. I think the very first one we were at was looking at medical again, medical services, medical education, but we did all of that in a local pub. And it was a really informal way to get people talking, to get people involved. And it seemed like a really inclusive space. Very comforting to go to those sorts of things on your own and be accepted really quickly. And I really started to enjoy those informal opportunities to learn from other people and find out what design meant. So, like I say, I stumbled across it within that master's course, but it quickly became a passion when I realised that, I enjoyed it. That was the very first thing, was that I really enjoyed doing design and learning about different systems and processes and behaviours, and how that then led to very common mistakes in businesses and opportunities as well.
Because at that point in time, it's probably, I don't know the exact date, but that must have been round about the sort of time where service design, the term, is starting to emerge and those practices are starting to be developed and popularized.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was something that I'd never heard of before, but I was still young at that point as well. And when I was so enthusiastic about it, I took all of these stories back to my mum. And at that point, she was working as the business development manager at Dundee and Angus College. And as I started to introduce these principles and methods and ways of working to her, she could see the value in it and started to apply that at the college. And that sparked a lot of interest in the executive at the college. And they were really supportive in building an interest in it at that point. So we're talking now 2017. And the college decided to go with what my mum was saying. Let's try something different. And if my mum was sat here, she'd be saying we tried lean, we'd done agile and all of these different sort of business ways of working. And they were going through a big merger at the time with Dundee and Angus College merging. And she would use rapid improvements events to try and get that consensus between both colleges for moving forward. And she could see the downfalls in that. So there was an opportunity for service design to come into the college really quickly. And Open Change supported the college with running the first GovJam. So it was a global GovJam in 2017, hosted at Dundee and Angus College. The first one to run in Dundee. And there was 85 people turned up. So we thought it might be quite popular, but we weren't quite expecting that number. And at that point, we realised, okay, there's a need for this, there's a want for it. And we started to research and realised really quickly that there was no introductory level training for service design in Scotland. And as we started to look further afield, it seemed like there wasn't very many opportunities for people to get into service design unless you wanted to do it as part of a master's or something like that. So we could see the opportunity for upskilling people, you know, people that are already in work, that are looking for different ways of working. And we started to create the Professional Development Award in Service Design. And that was right at the very start of my career. And that's why I say I fell into it. I was so lucky at that time that the college was open to new opportunities and that they were willing to support us to build a quite a small business off the side of the college to look at what that would mean, start doing market research and user research into what that would look like, and then start experimenting with what an introductory course in service design would feel like for people.
And so you sort of mentioned like there's other methodologies that had been there previously. And do you feel like service design is now something that has become so widely adopted and used that it's here to stay? Or do you think it will have its time in the same way that these other methodologies and other things have had their peak and then sort of fade off?
Absolutely. It's a good question. And when I started to really get into service design and doing research into where it came from, you know, it's actually a term that's been used over like the last 25, 30 years. And one of the founders of started using this term was Birgit Magar. And she's the president of the Service Design Network now. I started to really fall in love with the work that she'd done over the years, whether that was around homelessness or whether it was around education. And she was really somebody that I looked up to. And I remember seeing her for the very first time. I was sat like a fangirl is at the front of the conference with all my pens out, ready to take notes as she was doing the keynote speech. And she said something about service design that's always stuck with me. And that's that it has the Heinz effect, the Heinz tomato sauce effect. In that glass jar, when you're trying to get a tiny little bit out of service design, and then all of a sudden, it's everywhere. And that's her you know, her approach, her vision of it. She's been doing it for so long, and then all of a sudden it was everywhere. And only now that I realise that what we've created as a training experience is extremely important for the industry to make it credible, so that people aren't just going away and doing, you know, half day courses or 1-2 day courses and calling themselves service designers off the back of it. I think the difference, and I will say this because I love service design, I think the difference between service design and all of those other methodologies is the human element that comes into it. And the world that we live in now, if we can start to be more human and start to take a step back and ask questions rather than making those assumptions, and that's in any form of life, then it's going to be a better place going forward. And we're really starting to see the public sector particularly taking the opportunity to upskill people and to learn service design so that they can start creating services that are fit for purpose. And I mean, that's on a small scale at the moment, even in considering the Scottish approach to service design, which has been out for probably about 5 years now. And that was something at the time that was massive. You know, the government are, they're holding the flag up for service design. They're going to start doing this. And they produced a playbook. And that sort of, from my perspective anyway, that sort of lost a bit of traction. The government have so many designers now, but a lot of them are contractors. And a lot of them don't have, you know, stability within the government they are. And I think that there's been a big focus because of COVID, you know, that dropped off, and there was the focus on being reactive again instead of being proactive and thinking about what the future holds for services.
Yeah, and I think when you're talking there, there's a lot of those elements, especially that human element that's often very difficult to comprehend or grasp mm-hmm. without going and speaking to people.
Yeah.
And I think it's that empathy
mm-hmm.
that can be the difference between a design or a piece of work being okay and being amazing.
Absolutely.
And that, I think that sort of transcends across like many different elements and disciplines like within design itself, but I mean it's very much front and centre of service design.
Absolutely. And now we're starting to see it play out across all industries. You know, so we can sit and say that we've got people coming on our courses and that want to learn service design and that are practicing it really, really well across all sectors. You know, private sector have probably got a wee bit more experience in using it and have maybe more mature design teams because they've got maybe more money to be able to support that within their organisations. But we're certainly seeing it across all sectors where people are seeing the value in it and being able to undertake a course that they can apply it to their workplace at the same time gives that experience. And like you were saying, unless you go and speak to somebody, unless you learn by doing in this space, from my perspective, it's very difficult to look at service design and look at it as a process. You know, the double diamond is very well known in the service design world, but it's not really how it works in the real world. You know, it is just that, it's a process. And I'm actually in the midst of writing a chapter for a book on service design in higher education. And I'm focusing in on the impact of service design education. And one of the main parts of that is around the process and how it is a lovely place to start. And as an academic, you know, teaching it, we need to have that starting point. And it's a beautiful visual to be able to guide people. And it's almost like a safety blanket for designers starting, knowing where they are in the process or having that to point to maybe a tool or a method that might be suitable for that part of what they're doing. But ultimately, as you get out into the world and you're practicing it, you realise how much uncertainty comes with that and how much the people that you speak to and the data that you collect need to inform everything that you're doing. And that's something that I'm interested in more now. We speak about data, you know, data driven, but actually that's all about humans. It's all about the information, the behaviours that we get from them and understanding their lived experiences that help us drive forward different ways of working. So that for me is a big part, and it's the empathy part. As I started to get into design, that really changed my outlook on the world. you know, I'll go on holiday and I'll be like noticing different things. I'm like, that's been service designed, that's not. And I go through the world now looking at things through a different lens and taking a step back and actually thinking about people more as people and not judging as much as I used to in my younger years, definitely. That's something that personally I think service design's given me, that ability to step back and think about different experiences and how that might affect somebody and how they come across on a day to day.
And you've sort of, I suppose you've talked through the initial starting point and you've sort of gone through to, I suppose, sort of where you are now, but at what point in that journey do you feel you became a designer?
I don't even know if I would call myself a designer now, because I truly believe that what I'm doing and my purpose at the moment is that education piece. So it's a very difficult thing to split up. I design learning experiences for people, but I do that in a service design way. So I'm using all of the design processes, the methodologies, the skills, the soft skills that come with it and that connection with people. That's helped me to design learning experiences to teach service design. So it's quite in on itself at the moment. And this is one thing that we have conversations with in our team at the Service Design Academy, is that at the moment we're named consultants. That is our job title, our service design consultants. But we don't do consultancy. It's all about education. And I suppose we were speaking before we came on here about my experiences of education and being pretty much screwed over by different systems in education across my journey. And that's one thing that I think we need to even get better at, is what we're calling ourselves. When it comes to it, I'm an educator. That's what my passion is and that's what I do. But I help people to design.
Okay. So, but do you... if you're helping people design, are you helping them become designers, or do they design without being designers?
Exactly. This is something that is so important to us at the moment and something that we're discussing all the time, because we're seeing more and more secret service designers. So these are people that maybe already be doing design and they come on our course to either get the accreditation, you know, gather the proof that that's how they've been working and they've got the badge of honour afterwards, that accreditation of I can do this. It might be that they want to upskill and move jobs, or it might be that their boss has told them that they should be on the service design course, so they're there. So we see lots of different people coming on our courses and not necessarily leaving and saying, I'm a service designer, but using those skills and those values that they've picked up throughout those experiences to then do their job better. So there's a real conversation to have around that, where we're seeing a lot more people utilising the skills but never having the job title of service design. And I think that's where I want to go with it. I want service design to be for everyone. And that doesn't necessarily mean that everybody's doing it. But if we can start to think about it as, if you're thinking about an organisation and you want to use design methodology or design approaches to be able to make that a better organisation, whether that's focusing on your customers, whether that's on your employees, or whether that's your systems and processes, you can use all of the different things that we're teaching you. But as long as everybody in that organisation has an awareness of that's how you work, that I will ask you what you think about it. I want your insights. I want you to feed into how that system works or how that process runs. And then you've got the people who might be practicing it, you know, coming along and taking part in a workshop or giving feedback and insight to a design or to a prototype. And then you've got the people who are, you know, the working practitioners, the ones who are delivering the workshops within that organization or having those conversations to gather the insights. And then you've got the expert level, you know, the ones that are using that data to then inform business context and make changes across an organization. So I'm not saying that everybody has to come and do service design education, although that would be great. What I'm saying is the awareness of working in a different way and putting humans in front of those systems and processes is where I see value in business life going forward.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting sort of like almost decoupling that language of like, you don't need to be a designer, you don't need to call yourself a designer. you can utilize all these bits and pieces that we give you and all these skills, and almost see it like a core competency in the same way as maths or grammar or like those sorts of things that everyone gets to learn.
Absolutely. And that leads really nicely on to the fact that I see service design being such a valuable piece for how we change the world of education, and how I truly believe that if we did teach some of these elements, you know, that empathy piece or the sitting and being able to listen to people on different levels, if we did teach things like that at a very early age, how different would the world be today? If everybody had that little bit more understanding of each other and themselves. So I do think it should be something like a core competency, and you know, and I don't think it would be called service design, you know, but we see elements of this happening, you know, across in Nordic countries like Helsinki, where they're using action-based approaches to learning, and that's on world events that happen right then and there. So when I was in Helsinki doing a design tour, the young people were working on wildfires. So, you know, understanding that, thinking about the causes and the effects of that and how they could potentially reduce wildfires happening, because there was a wildfire happening right then, it was on the news. So they were learning in real time. And that's something I think would be super valuable for our education system and for our kids, you know, to actually make them much more aware of what's going on in the world and give them the ability to be able to contribute back to communities, to their societies afterwards, because they've got that awareness. Whereas I think at the moment, education doesn't quite cover all of those things. You know, I don't think I've ever used Pythagoras since I've left school. But I'm sure maybe one day it'll come in useful.
But then I think as well, there's other... So as you say, there's lots of things that you learned in that sort of core education that you've never really taken forward. But because paths are created and you have to tick that box and finish that exam and to get on to the next thing. But there's lots of more practical skills like wiring plugs and...
Yep.
Like just all those things that you kind of... You'd be great to understand and have that knowledge that would probably help you more than some of the other stuff you learn. But then how it seems like a huge challenge to change the current system and embed that from the start.
Yeah.
So I'm not expecting you to solve this right now. but how do we start to do that?
I think we've started to have conversations with people, and I'm saying conversations with people. I'm trying to make people hear. You know, I feel like sometimes we are literally shouting from the rooftops and there's nobody listening. And then there's other times when I think, actually, you know what, I've affected a couple of people there in that system and that's going to change. And there will be things that go off against that. But I do genuinely think that it is about telling stories, about the narrative that comes with the experiences that we have as we're growing up through that and what we feel is missing in education. I know that it's complex and it's messy, and you're right, where do you start with it? We're seeing different things that are really encouraging, like the Design Club, which was founded down in England, and we introduced it to Dens Road Primary School a couple of years ago, where they're starting to bring young people into that space and give them the opportunity to be designing apps or, you know, playing about with user research and going out and doing some discovery. And that was really, really enthusiastic. I loved that. I thought it was absolutely brilliant. We were working with like primary five students and their enthusiasm for it. They just want to soak up all of that knowledge and be able to use it. So I think things like that, little design clubs and, you know, feeding those sorts of things into schools, but ultimately supporting teachers at this moment in time. I mean, it needs to start someplace. And if we can have teachers and educators realise that there are different ways of being able to teach very fundamental core skills, then we can possibly affect change. That's not to say that the teachers don't already want to do that, you know, and I don't know if they feel boxed in by the system and, you know, broken by the system, because sometimes I certainly do. We did a project with Arbroath Academy about 4 years ago now, I think it was. And that really did open my eyes to the possibility, if you've got the right leadership at the helm of a school, And the head teacher approached us, wanted to, you know, what we were, wanted to know what we were doing and how it could possibly play out in a high school. And we worked with the teachers, the support staff, the administration staff. We had caretaking staff in there. We invited people from across different council departments, people within the education sector, within the parent and teacher association to be involved in that. All in different workshops and different forms of being able to contribute to that. And the findings that came from it really do align with my thinking of what young people want. And that's not me going, I know what young people want. It's them telling us, this is what we would love to learn. And you said about like the wiring of the plugs and things. It was like, how do you boil pasta? How do you, like, I've still not nailed that as an adult. You know, how do you boil pasta? How do you make your tea? How do you get a mortgage? What's a mortgage? You know, I'd like a bank account. How do I get a bank account? I'd like a bank card. So we started to investigate how we could bring these world life things back to school. And the young people were making suggestions like, oh, it'd be so cool if we had a garage outside. We could learn about cars. We could bring cars in here. Or maybe the banks could come and visit us and tell us about bank accounts. And these are things that the young people are saying. They're not being fed this information. They realise that this is things that they could potentially need going forward. So that for me was a big turning point in being able to influence different ways of learning. And that's probably where my passion was really struck up around using service design in education and how that could possibly change the way that we all live in the future. I started working with two fantastic ladies, Brad Knutton, who is now just been made a professor. She'll be really chuffed that I got that in there. She's just been made a professor. She works down in Lancaster University, and Jean Mutton, who was using service design principles within education support for years and years before she retired and set up her own company. And we started to think about all of the different ways that we could possibly bring service design to education. And Radka, coming from a university perspective, has an even more complex system, you know, an ecosystem to be working in. So we started to do little events and started to build up a community of people who were interested in this. And, you know, at its most, we maybe had 80 people or so involved in those different events. And that led us on to the creation of EduJam. I said right at the very start, my career basically started with a jam. And we've got Adam St. John Lawrence and his crew to be able to thank for the ability to get into service design through jams and the ability to create networks and communities from that. So we've ran two EduJams to date. We did one just after COVID hit, so it was online. We had a fantastic turnout from people all over the world joining us, and it was really unbelievable what you can do from your kitchen table. We had such an amazing event, and we had people speaking from Public Health Scotland. We had Adam St. John Lawrence come and do a session. We had people, like I say, from all over the world join in on that. And that starts to spark a momentum across different people. And even if you don't see all of those things continuing to go on, I still hear about them. You know, I might not be involved in the projects, but you're still connected with people and you still hear what value that brought, or, you know, how that changed their mindset and how they're going back into their workplace thinking differently. And I think even if you can do that a couple of times, you know, within those jam spaces, then we're onto something.
And so you've talked a lot about the application and the projects that you've worked on and how things have developed and progressed. But to come back to you, so in all this, where do you feel that, like, your expertise lies?
It's probably contradictory from what you've said earlier, because I do believe that I do have good experience in service design. We've done different projects and we've been able to apply that, but it's always been with that educational lens. It's always been about building capacity. It's never, for me, been about going into some place, an organisation or a team, and solving their problems for them. So I suppose my expertise will lie in that creation of an environment where people feel that they can learn, that they can change, that they can admit failure in an open space and be able to use that to move forward. I've just recently become the team manager for my team, and I think that's really challenged me recently, realizing that when you become a manager, you do a lot less work focus and it's a lot more people focus. And I suppose my experiences of doing these different workshops, of creating these experiences, have helped me to be a better manager, learning about the difficulties that come with work life, you know, that balance of everything that we do. So it's a very interesting question, actually. I've worked in the education system since I was 16, in one form or another. I started at Dundee and Angus College, what was Dundee College at the time, doing filing, because my mum said, are you hell going to sit on your ass and do nothing, when I left school at 15. And I've worked in that space for such a long time across different departments and worked on different projects. So I definitely think that there's that balance between design and education being my expertise. And I suppose that is what I was saying, is that I feel like I'm an educator more than I'm a designer, but I'm designing education to make it better.
So yeah, obviously, like, having worked with many different groups of people, mm-hmm. coming from lots of different industries or backgrounds or experience, and bringing with them lots of different experiences,
mm-hmm.
what are the barriers or the issues or the things that you find that you come up against potentially over and over again that stop you being able to do what you want to do?
So I think one of the main common problems that we have across organisations and teams is communication. And I think that comes in lots of different ways and means that either prevent us or enable us to be able to do things. And the communication across organisations and teams, it breaks down as soon as people go to work in different departments, and we'll hear that all the time, oh, you're working in silos. And I can't remember who said it to me, but I'll always remember it's silos are the place where smart people go to do stupid things. And we just shut off, don't we? Because we're so involved in what we're doing on a day-to-day. And I think that not understanding how other people work and how other people want to be communicated with and how that plays out across organisations is a big thing for us. It's something that comes up time and time and time again. The other thing, funnily enough, is time. People seem, after COVID, to be busy all the time. There's no stop. You know, we often see organisations coming to us and they're struggling because there isn't a balance in what they're doing, and they're constantly being reactive to the issues that come their way or the opportunities that come their way, probably more importantly, is being reactive in that sense and not having a balance of being able to focus on what's important and focus on what we just do on a day-to-day. So I suppose our role in that is being able to give people that space to really think about what's important to the business, what's important to the employees, and what's important to your end users and your customers, and give them that opportunity to think it through. People will often come away and be surprised at how quickly the time's gone with us because we've covered so much, because we've provided that space for them to learn and to learn about themselves as well.
I suppose you talk super confidently, and I kind of want to flip that a little bit and mm-hmm. say, how do you deal with the tough times? How do you deal with the rejections
mm-hmm.
or the negativity?
Yeah, I talk confidently, but I think that's a mask. I think that's something that I've built up over time from working in a public-facing role for pretty much all my life. If you speak confidently, then people will believe you. And I suppose I speak confidently about service design because I believe in it. But the things that really get me are I suppose a brilliant example of this is going in as a facilitator and facilitating events where people have come to you with their idea. They already know what they want, and they're using service design as a tick box exercise. That breaks my little heart. And as a facilitator, there's only so far you can go with that, because you are just that, a facilitator, and you don't always have the autonomy to say, I don't think you should do that. Or, you know, it's sometimes not my place to say, you shouldn't do that. You should listen to what these people are saying and run with that. And I think the first project that happened, it was really demoralising for me because it happened within the college space. And I felt that actually dented the reputation of design. You know, we've invited all of these people along to this workshop and we're going to get all of their information and we've done all of this user research and collected all of this information for you to just turn it around and say, no, I'm going to do what I want to do anyway. And that's real life, isn't it? It's where the people who have got the money or the decision making, they've got the power. And those are things that get me down. Those are the things that I want to battle against. And I have to sit back and go, is this something that you should be battling? Or do we just go, okay, that's fine, and move on? And that's certainly something that I've learned over the last few years, is to be resilient in that space, is to not let those people who aren't willing to change or to look outside their own space and realise that you're not going to win them all.
Can you unpack that a little bit and sort of how do you make that decision and how do you know when it's right to walk away?
When I'm using energy that isn't positive, when I feel like, and it's probably, it's that human feeling again. It's that human aspect of getting to a stage where you think, we could keep battling against this here. And what change is that going to make? What value is that going to bring for those people within that process? And you can battle against it, but then it's just creating tension, isn't it? And I think that if it was something super important, then I would stick to my guns. And that needs to be something, you know, that's going to make a massive change. The example I gave there, I didn't want to give too much away because I don't want to be disrespectful to anybody. Because, you know, that person that made that decision has got a lot of experience in that field. So it's not like they're coming in there blindsided and saying, oh, I'm making decisions for decision's sake. What was difficult and what was difficult at that point was involving so many different people and feeling like you're letting them down too. And I think that's why I was trying to make that differentiation between being a facilitator, because I can come in and I can help to guide or follow people through a process. But ultimately, it has to be their decisions. It has to be their mindset flip, because I could force a decision to be made at that point if it felt right. But then that work wouldn't continue afterwards. And I think that's the education piece for me, is that I want people to get to a stage where they feel that they're doing this as part of their day job for the right reasons. And not like I say, just to tick those boxes.
To turn it back and look more positively.
Mm-hmm.
In your day-to-day, what is it that motivates you? And where do you find inspiration?
On a day-to-day basis, working with the Service Design Academy team inspires me. We're getting more people in as we grow, as capacity is needed in the team. And somebody described the team the other week as professional but quirky. So we're taking that as a compliment. And I think the things that I learn from my team on a day-to-day basis, because they all have an inspired view on design and different passions within that as well. So, you know, whether that's from climate change to AI to inclusive and accessible design, we all have our little passions, and that comes through every day in the way that we work together. I believe that we work really well as a team, and I think that's because of our differences. We elevate those as much as possible, and we are always checking ourselves against each other, you know, and making sure that we're always pushing each other as well. So I think that's the one thing that, you know, the team that I work with and the people that I work with, and being able to work in this space, you know, alongside the college, very much part of the college, but having the freedom to try new things and experiment with what education could look like in a different way, that keeps me motivated to keep trying new things. And I think the team definitely inspire me. I think the other thing on a day-to-day at the moment is that I'm starting to see how design could be played out in organisations, more focused on the employee experience as well. So recently my husband and I took over Green Thumb franchise. So we took over Dundee territory in 2021, in September 21. And it's very much Michael's business. But over the years of hearing me speak about design, it's been really motivating for me to see him apply those principles and values to the way that he's built his business. And I'll go in and do little service design experiences with them, but ultimately the experiences that he's creating for his team and the successes that we can see off the back of that, I get to see it play out in the real world at the same time as educating. And that's something for me that at the moment I'm really inspired by, and seeing how it can work even in lawn treatment companies, you know, that it does play out in lots of different industries, and it can be successful if you've got the right people there driving with the right mindset.
And so, I mean, to build on that even a bit more, like, so what is it, like, looking to the future, mm-hmm. what excites you?
That service design keeps growing, that people do see the value in it, and that it becomes part of everyday life within business and even possibly education in the, you know, in the future. That's something that will always continue to drive me forward. I think that on a day-to-day, the things that really inspire me are seeing our students become successful and making a difference in people's lives. You know, a lot of the students that we see are coming from public services, so ultimately they're going back, they're doing their job better. That's going to benefit you and me, yeah, in the long term. It's feeding back into society, it's making services better. So I think that is a really long, open goal of continuing to see people be successful off the back of service design and service design education. It's something that drives me forward. And then, like I said, about the franchise thing, being able to see Green Thumb be successful and being able to play out into that, into service design in that different industry, has given me a lot of motivation recently. And that I can see that leads to real successes for people. So I think that's the thing that keeps me going, absolutely, is that open goal of the tomato sauce effect on Heinz, you know, that tomato sauce effect of service design, it literally being everywhere. There's still that opportunity.
Another, like, spaces, industries, places where you think that's totally untapped, like that, and it could really benefit from this?
Yeah, well, I mean, going into the franchise world is one thing that I've really found interesting, and it's not a business aspect that I've ever considered before or ever really come across, even with the students that come in to teach service design. So I think that's probably an untapped place that would be really interesting. Because franchises and the way that they work, it's normally, you know, a small local business behind them. And I think that there's a lot of opportunity for people to be able to be successful and grow using these sorts of ways of working. So I think that's probably one thing. Like I say, we get quite a variety of people that come on the course to do service design. We've had people who are alternative therapists come on, and they're using it to build their business, create a new website, understand what their users need from their therapies, right through, like I say, up to government. So it's there in little golden spots across all of the business map, but there's definitely opportunities to keep tapping into it in other places.
And so before we finish up, is there anything that you could recommend that you've been listening to, watching, reading recently?
Yeah, absolutely. I was lucky enough to undertake a design leadership course a couple of years ago now. And that was when I first heard about Indy Young. Indy Young is a fantastic researcher, and that is really doing disjustice to everything that she does in the world. She's a fantastic designer and researcher. And the really interesting thing for me about Indy and her book is Time to Listen. It goes further than any user research book that I've ever read before, and it's starting to think about people and their purpose, and that for me is really refreshing. Going beyond that business lens of service design and really tapping into, you know, people's feelings in a way that helps us to understand their purpose, which is not a job, it's not, you know, a task to do, it's something much wider. And getting into that mindset of understanding people's purpose and how that drives forward their behaviours is something that I'm really interested in at the moment. So just started that book, Time to Listen, but it would definitely be one that I would recommend from Indy Young.
So yeah, so if anyone wants to get in touch, reach out, find you online.
Absolutely.
Where would they do that?
I am on LinkedIn, Katie Murray. It's just spelt like Murray, but it's not. I'm on LinkedIn, and you'd be able to contact us through Service Design Academy as well. Not a problem to get in touch with them through our sort of generic mailbox and then sort of into my mailbox. Yeah.
Great. Well, thanks very much. So thank you so much to Katie for coming and doing the episode. Lots of lovely little quotes and stuff. I really enjoyed the silos are where smart people go to do stupid things. Yeah, I really enjoyed that. I'll need to find out where that's from. But yeah, and definitely a few topics and things that popped up in there that I might try and explore further with other guests and in further discussions, particularly around the sort of core competency and creative skills and how we start to do that or ways in which that's already been done. For sure. But yeah, that's pretty much it for this week, and I'll be back next week with another episode, and then I'm going to have a little bit of a break to allow people to sort of catch up, and then I'll have a, I suppose it's like a mid-season break, if you like, and then I'll be back with another chunk of episodes in a few weeks. But yeah, one episode next week to look forward to, and that will be Chris Hunt of Scotland Redesign. Easiest way to keep up to date with everything that's happening with the podcast, follow on at CCC Dundee on X/Twitter and Instagram, and it's facebook.com/groups/CCC Dundee. And if you do want to support the podcast, you can go to ko-fi.com/CCC Dundee and you can buy me a cup of coffee, and that'll help me keep the podcast running, keep interesting guests in front of the microphone. But yeah, that's it. Until next week. Bye.